This is Mete Yurtsever, a host of Formula for Creating Value. Today, my guest is Head of High Performance at VegaFactor, Rich Deck, from New Jersey. Welcome, Rich.
Thank you, Mete. Great to be with you today.
Thank you for coming. So let me introduce you to our audience briefly. So Rich studied operations research and industrial engineering at Cornell University, and he's now heading the high performance practice at VegaFactor. He's a consultant, he's an executive coach and public speaker. So Rich, I want to start like with from the discussion to from motivation. Until recently, I've been a great believer of Daniel Pink's this purpose, autonomy and mastery. But after I watched Lindsay at Engage, your colleague, and I migrated totally to your model. And I said, that's it. This is play, purpose, and potential. So you have a basketball background, right? And I know you talked a lot about motivation. So what motivates people?
Yes, Mete, it's a great question. And it's funny because you'll ask different people what motivates them, and you'll get different answers. You know, you might ask a surgeon, like, well, what motivated you to become a surgeon? And a surgeon might say, I wanted to make a lot of money, right? Which in our language is economic pressure, doing it for the reward or to avoid a consequence. But fundamentally, the surgeon also might have said, hey, I just love medicine. I love the learning of how to practice that craft. And I've enjoyed it. It's something I enjoy. So in that case, that's the motive of play, doing something for the sake of the activity. And the surgeon may also say, I love the purpose. I love being able to really help people with my craft and save lives and, you know, help people live better lives again, which is the second motive. Third motive is potential, as you mentioned, and that is where you're doing something now to get to somewhere else later on. So that surgeon might say, hey, I love medicine, but also I want to teach. I'm practicing as a surgeon now, but eventually I want to teach at a healthcare institution. So those are, as you mentioned, some of the direct motives. But also people can do things for emotional pressure if they feel guilted into doing something. That surgeon may become a surgeon because their parents were surgeons and they felt pressured right to go into it. So the whys vary, but fundamentally we all have a why for doing things.
Right. So how did you come up with this model? That's based on research, I suppose.
It is. So our co-founders at VegaFactor and the co-authors of Prime to Perform, Lindsay McGregor and Neil Doshi, when they were doing their research, they built on a lot of the research that was done in the late 1960s at the University of Rochester by Edward Deci and Richard Ryan, who were the founders of the self-determination theory and that path of research. So some of our research builds on a lot of the great work that they started.
Uh-huh. So that's pretty scientific work. And when I look at practices at the organizations, so why they don't really get into this intrinsic values, but rather they keep pushing the extrinsic values?
Yeah, Mete, it's so a couple of reasons. One is it's so ingrained in us. I mean, if we think back to Taylorism, you know, the whole movement of let's come up with the best way of doing something, standardize it, and then roll it out and scale it. You know, kind of hardcore, old school industrial engineering techniques. You know, most of the time people think only of tactical performance. Like, let's come up with the best way. Let's lock it in and let's scale it out. And there's a lot of rigidity around that. So that is kind of one piece that is held deeply in across the globe, frankly, around performance. And then I think there's been this second wave where more leaders and organizations have realized that culture is important to performance, you know, important to helping people thrive and feel good at work, and all the energy around psychological safety, inclusion, equity, you know, innovation, agility, fail fast, like the common themes that most people are looking for. So there's energy around those that to kind of take Taylorism to the next level. But organizations, I think many of them are still struggling with how to solve for those. Like just telling someone to be innovative or be inclusive isn't going to have a growth mindset isn't enough. We need to fundamentally change how teams get work done, business units get work done, and organizations get work done. So it's really kind of marrying and bringing together next generation culture work merges with next generation performance organizational work.
Uh-huh. And actually, yeah, you talk about also this identity of an organization. So how different is that from mission and values?
Yeah, the identity, I see really as kind of the behaviors that exist in the organization. Yeah, a lot of times organizations will, you know, talk their mission and values, but their behaviors are different than that. Now, the behaviors, though, are a byproduct of how the organization runs operationally. So you might, you know, a lot of times people are talking about customer centricity as a common theme. But in reality, if certain processes in your organization, if there's such, let's say if people are experienced weaponized metrics, that there's such pressure to hit their numbers, if not, they may not have a job. There's a good chance then people will behave in a way that is not customer centric. So there's very often many organizations a disconnect between their desired, you know, values, mission, et cetera, or the behaviors that they want, but their operating model is causing people to function and behave in a very different way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when it comes to the role of the structure and planning of an organization, how that plays a role in motivation?
Yeah, it's a big one. It's for a couple of reasons. So if you have a structure that we would call in our language low tomo, is when the indirect motives of emotional pressure, economic pressure, and inertia outweigh the intrinsic or direct motives of play, purpose, and potential. Very often in those cases, you have very siloed organizations where work is like thrown over the wall to you. Like you don't really understand what's happening upstream. Work is handed over to you. You treat it like a task, and then you pass it along to someone else. So as a result of that, it's kind of hard to understand the impact of your work, which is the purpose motive. And it's also hard to come up with ideas to come up with do things better if you're in a very kind of narrow, you know, lane. So that's kind of the low tomo side on structure and planning. And also in low tomo sides of structure and planning, very much priorities are set from the top. So it's deeply command and control. So it's hard for people to even have space to innovate or be creative, because the pressures to do the same thing over and over again are pretty strong. On a high tomo org structure and planning, it's both top-down planning meets bottoms-up planning. Teams have a sense of control over their priorities. They're regularly coming up with better ways to do their work based on what they are directly learning, how their work is impacting their either internal or external customer. So that is a significant driver of motivation in people and teams.
Okay, so if you can give an example Lindsay gave this example of a teacher or any other example that you may think of. I mean, I think that will illustrate better for the audience.
Yeah, so I'll start with a large insurance company. So for, you know, the starting point was, and this was kind of operational teams, you know, people working in a contact center. And for a while, they were very command and control as an organization. So very top-down driven. In our language, deep tactical performance, you know, follow the script, follow the play, very little space to innovate, do things differently. And in partnership with a new leader that came on, really kind of changed how work was done. And, you know, and for a while, even when people shared ideas, nothing would happen. I'd call it, they'd go in the idea cloud. So very siloed, deep command and control, highly tactical organization and way of running. And one of a couple of the shifts were is like, let's move decision-making locally to teams. So now all of a sudden our teams, frontline teams are coming up with ways so that people can get their benefits faster during a time of great need and accelerate the decision-making process of people on the front lines and raise the limits for when they can release funds quickly to customers. And the fact that they were able to put something like that in days, whereas before it would never happen or it would take 6 months to happen, all of a sudden now people are seeing they're not just coming up with ideas, but they're able to rapidly implement their ideas in their teams. So now as a result of that, people are more motivated. They're coming up with ideas that are helping their customers, helping themselves save time, and they're also improving the efficiency of the business, all the same way by really increasing the localized ownership in those teams. They also would jump and say, even though we're siloed, there's nothing stopping us from reaching across the aisle and talking to some of our colleagues on other teams, and let's have a broader discussion amongst us to come up with better ways we can work. How can we help you do your work? And here are some ideas that we think you might be able to help us with, but we want to make sure we're still doing the right thing for our customer.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually about changing the habits in a team work, right?
100%. It is 100% is a major lever about the habits within teams. And, you know, you asked, you know, there's, you know, a lot of times organizations expect like, oh, you know, the only way to make things better is if like the C-suite changes things. But exactly as you described, Meta, if teams can improve their habits, if people can improve their own habits around motivation, and teams can focus on their own habits and their and you know build in high tomo habits in their team, that goes a long way for boosting motivation, performance, and customer impact.
So what you're saying is that is there any hope that even the leader is not, you know, has the right mentality, but can teams work out something between themselves?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Well, that's a great news for most companies.
You know, it's also, I would also add two meta. It's, you know, again, it's, you know, it's, you know, teams can control that one. It's easier when you have other people in the organization doing it, but fundamentally, if your team is doing it, that's helping your, you know, the people on the team, you're helping yourself. And it's a bit of making it easier to deal with the other low tomo influences that you might be facing. And the same is true in people's personal lives. Like if people are making decisions in their non-work lives to boost play, purpose, and potential and reduce emotional pressure, economic pressure, and inertia, that will reduce their own stress in their non-work lives, which also then carries over to work. So the more we can spend time in our lives in the direct motives and less in the indirect motives, it builds our resiliency for stress, whether those stresses are at work or outside of work.
Okay. So, but on the, let's say, positive scenario, or let's say on the ideal scenario, what would be the role of the leader? What skills they should possess?
Yeah, the first is, I would say, less a skill, but an understanding of this, of our science and research, like understanding that there are two types of performance. There is the tactical performance I mentioned, but also adaptive performance. Like teams need to innovate, make decisions on their own, experiment, problem solve, do things differently when they think is best. And that is so, it sounds so basic, but that is so key for leaders to understand that and the value of that for the team, for customers, for productivity, and for the leader themselves, that is a foundational piece. Because that leads to the next question, well, how do you build that in your teams? And that's where the six motives comes in. And then the question is, well, how do I create those motives? And that's exactly as you surfaced earlier, Mette, around it comes down to the team operating model and team habits. So the first piece to learn is really like understand the research and science enough to start doing some of those habits differently on a team to increase the adaptive performance and better get tactical and adaptive performance in balance. Mm-hmm. As a starting block, I think one thing leaders can do is just track. I tell everybody, like, if one thing anyone could do is just track your motives over the course of the day. Am I doing something because I'm enjoying it now? Play? Am I doing something now because I want to see the impact of what I'm doing? Or am I doing something now because I'm afraid? I'm feeling stress, anxiety, FOMO, right? Guilt into doing something. That's, you know, or is that a reason that's present? Or am I doing something simply to try to get praised or avoid a consequence? I think merely tracking our own motives is step one for improving them.
Yeah, that's a great tip. So actually, these dimensions of motives, let's say, these pillars exist in both in the tactical and the adaptive jobs, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Can you give a bit more, another example about the type of work that the motivation influences for a tactical type of work and adaptive type of performance, I would say?
Yeah, Mette, one thing just to clarify is I think, you know, every job needs a mix of adaptive and tactical performance. You know, sometimes people might think, okay, if it's a, you know, if it's a manufacturing job or a job in a call center, that's really tactical. Like, we know the best processes for that. Therefore, there's no need for adaptive performance. Other jobs, we need a lot more adaptive performance. And that's not true. So, for example, like if we were to contrast, you know, back in the 80s, you know, in the U.S., the General Motors, you know, way of working in their plants was extremely tactical and command and control. And when Toyota took over the plant and it hired back pretty much the same people and built in a different operating model that focused way more on learning, stopping to fix problems, rapid experimentation, problem solving, no blame people, no weaponization of metrics as people were experiencing under General Motors. Uh-huh. As a result of that, people thrive. Like, productivity doubled, quality was up over 30% simply by changing the operating model in a manufacturing plant. Same people, same equipment, but changing the operating model boosted productivity and quality. And a lot of people be like, well, and implementing a lot of things that drove adaptive performance that didn't exist before. Same thing is true in contact centers. You know, when people, if people are feel like they're having a script read to them, that's too much tactical performance. you know, when we talk to someone on a contact center, I don't know if you've experienced it, where someone solves something, like it's a challenging problem and they're able to solve it. That's great adaptive performance versus being overly rigid on a script.
That's a great example. But how do you operationalize this when you go to a client, let's say? And so how do you address the issues? Where do you start? What is your starting point?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mehta. Our starting point is to share the science. So we'll typically start with an organization. Whether pre-COVID, we would do it in person. We've also do them virtually. Is typically a 90-minute or 2-hour interactive discussion keynote sharing the science of performance and motivation, just to ground people on the science and make it real for them and actionable on things that they can start with. So education and inspiration is really step one. And then from there, you know, if organizations are interested, we do some leadership work, essentially help teams and business units and organizations learn the habits of high-performing teams. So that's kind of sometimes step two, that or executive coaching. Step three would be deeper implementation work to help really transform business units or organizations and how they get their work done.
I see. Okay. So, and there are also some, let's say, maybe I may say skills required for collaboration and let's say for communication. So one of the things I have seen also like on your social posts that you gave the little formula of how to collaborate and communicate more and in less number of meetings, let's say. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's such a common conundrum that people are facing. Like people want to be included. I want to collaborate. I want to learn. But I can't stand meetings, right? So how do you solve for that?
Exactly.
A couple things. One is to kind of shift the meetings themselves. Like very often meetings are not productive. And there's a host of, I would say, basic meeting hygiene things that get in the way of that. Not having an agenda, not clear of roles, a couple people talking too much. Like there's a whole host of things. And the second piece is typically to change it from a status update, meaning a lot of teams still run classic status updates where everyone gets in a room or virtually on a call and they share their update. And really very few people are paying attention unless you're facilitating or the leader and you're giving the update or you're about to give the update. Like
exactly.
Most organizations are attacks like that. They're not that productive. And the more those can change, you know, do the updates offline asynchronously and use the meeting time for problem solving. Like, okay, here's a challenge we have. Let's tap the collective power of thinking of people on this team cross-functionally to solve it and come up with a better way of doing it. So changing meetings from tactical status update meetings to collaborative problem-solving meetings is a major step forward. The other piece around it is how not only what you do in a meeting, but how you collaborate outside of the meeting reduces the need to have meetings to collaborate. So if teams are collaborating asynchronously well, where people are able to, share first drafts with each other. There's a level of transparency in people's work that will help leaders and also help colleagues layer in ideas and suggestions for other people's work such that a meeting's not required to collaborate or review anything. It also reduces the odds that someone's going to spend 40 hours on a PowerPoint and share it with their leader who looks at it and is like, that's not what I was looking for. So working in smaller bites, smaller layers, time boxing, how long to work on things outside of meetings and doing that transparently gives speed and collaboration without meetings.
Uh-huh. That's a great tip. That's a great tip. We all suffered from it. I mean, I can say.
Yes, we have.
And I'd like to hear another tip on the trust issue. I mean, I consider that this is one of the major issue, like silos in organization. Most of the time, what actually stops collaboration is also the trust issue. What is your suggestions for as a remedy for that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, the trust is a byproduct of the operating model. So as you mentioned, Mehta, like if there are, let's say, deeply deep silos in the organization. So let's put together a toxic mix of a lot of silos in the organization. A lot of siloed goals, meaning let's say you and I are in siloed teams and your goal and my goal are different. And in a way, they're kind of against each other, so to speak. And let's say, there's a lot of pressure to hit numbers. And I'm using numbers in quotes because there's likely a better customer-centric frame around that. So if you have the toxic mix of silos, siloed goals, deep weaponization of metrics, deep pressure to hit numbers, and a lot of blame, that's going to create a toxic stew that is very low trust. Now, that's kind of the extreme case, but there are a number of teams and people operating in those kinds of conditions. So the more that the more people can understand how the roots of that, then they'll realize, like, okay, those are the root causes for why we're in this dynamic. That can then help people realize, like, that the people on the other side, like, they're not bad people, right? I'm not going to blame them back. But given even the way we're working, how can we change some of our habits to fix that? So what would that look like? I'm flashing in one of our partners right now. They kind of had that. But what they're starting to do more of is they're starting to spend time, you know, when they set their goals, to share them with each other. So here's our goal. Here's you know, my goal. And talk through that a bit. And also talk through a bit, like, what their plans are. What are their strategies for that? So they can get more aligned out of the gate. Now, if that's not happening at senior levels, even those in the front line can just start taking that step, cross the aisle, say, here's my goal, here's your goal. How can we collaborate better for the good of our customers and the good of our people? So that can start breaking those, you know, kind of break through that toxic stew. And then over time, there could be some shifts. Okay, let's change our goals. Like, wow, our goals are counter to each other. They're not as customer centric. You know, the silos that we're having are slowing us down as an organization. So part of it is getting to understand, learning the root, and then being able to control what you can despite those root issues, and then starting to change those roots of habits and the operating model that are getting in the way.
Yeah, that's a great tip. I mean, definitely, trust is a byproduct of all these factors, actually. I cannot get enough of it. Rich, give me one more. So sure. I think it's just the organization, the family is an organization too, right? And it's we are all, I mean, with our kids, struggling a little bit on motivation issue.
Yeah.
So let's do a fun exercise. I mean, like, I have my son, he's a fourth grader.
Yep.
And can you give me some tips on how to motivate him to do his homework?
Yes, absolutely. And I've been there, and I'm still there with my kids, Mehta. And you know, a couple of things. One is to think about the motives. So we actually do an exercise very similar to this in our keynote talks, where we'll ask people, using each one of the six motives, how would you motivate this young child? And what's interesting is the answers that come the quickest are emotional pressure. So imagine, you know, you say to your son, like, your friends do their homework every night. How come you don't? Right? Emotional pressure. Or economic yeah. pressure, right? Like, I'll give you your device back when you get your homework done, or I'll give you a dessert when you get your homework done. Economic pressure, right? And the answers like that come very quickly because we've all been there. We've done those with our kids. So the question, and they don't work well. They don't work sustainably. So the question is, how do you inspire versus coerce? It comes down to the direct motives. So with your fourth grade son, it could be, let's just for tonight, let's just try to get the first page of your homework done. If let's say there's multiple pages of math homework, let's just do the page one tonight, not worry about the other ones. Really make it bite sized. Or you could be like, how about this? Like, you do your homework and daddy's going to do, you know, his work at the same time next to you. Right. And you're kind of working in parallel, or it could be, let's just time how long it takes you to do it. Let's just, time, how long do you make it, how long do you think it will take for you to do your homework? Let's guess that. And then let's see how long it actually takes. Or let's just say for tonight, just spend 10 minutes doing your homework and see where you land and not worry about it. Like, kind of removing the pressure and then seeing what are some bite-sized steps, your son can take. I would also layer on the parenting side, some of my own insights relative to your question, Mehta, is that I found that our children have amazing radar for detecting when something is more important to us than it is them. That creates this further dissonance where they don't want to do it. So another answer could be is just maybe even like try maybe even letting go. Like, let's see what your son does if, for a week or two, you don't care if he doesn't do his homework, because it happens in school. Okay, you don't want to do it. Okay. And I share this because it was my son loves basketball. And a few years ago, when he was, similar ages as your son, he uh, you know, I would, you know, be traveling all week with clients, and then I'd come home on the weekends and I would ask him, and I would say, hey, Nolan, like, do you want to go, you know, practice shooting baskets? And in my head, I'm like, I'm being good dad. He loves to play basketball. He loves the game. He's pretty good as a kid playing. You know, I'm just want to be good. For me, it's fun. I'm going to ask him if he wants to play. But by me initiating the ask, by me initiating asking him first if he wanted to practice or play, all with the best intentions, like, you know, there was no like, no one, we have to go practice. We have to go like run a couple miles. None of that. Me just asking signaled that it was more important to me than it was him. And I destroyed his ownership in that meta. I destroyed it. And I destroyed it. And I saw it come through that he no longer loved the game. He was like, then would just say no. Like, I would ask him and he would say no. And I'd be devastated. And then the next weekend, I would do the same thing. And I'd be devastated. And then over time, like that year, his game plateaued. I could see him losing the joy of the game as I was coaching him. And then I realized what I was doing. I had to completely let go of me caring about basketball for him. I had to completely let go, which was extremely hard. And ironically, after I let go and I came peace, I'm like, you know what, if he quits basketball, I'm okay with it. Like, over time, he rebuilt, and now he is as a sophomore in high school, and he loves the game. And like, even in COVID, he's going out in cold weather and practicing. He's running on the track, training for the season, but he needed to own it. So I hear this because ownership is so paramount around motivation. And I think as parents, even with the best intentions, we often destroy it.
Yeah, that's so true. And we feel it every day. Like, to what extent we should, you know, resist the urge to interfere. And what if he completely quits? What if she completely quits playing the piano, whatever? Or what if he quits the basketball, things like that? But at the end, that's what happens. I mean, you're right. I mean, if you push it, you just kill the autonomous, let's say, act. And
Exactly. And I think really it's our own fear as parents or our own stuff that gets in the way and very often can destroy ownership in children and their hobbies, activities, and academics.
Yeah. And I had another epiphany when you said about this ways of motivating. I mean, like this emotional and all sort of this bribing stuff, let's say, it doesn't have the involvement. So they're easy. I mean, you say either I'll give you this or I won't give you this or whatever. That's easy. But to sit down together with your son and do something, or let's say, this requires involvement. And that's why it's hard. I mean, but unless you involve, you just cannot get any results.
Yeah, it's that. It's also sometimes going back to like, you know, maybe an experiment is to even just back off. Like, okay, and you know, it could be like, hey, I'll sit here and do my work and you sit there and do it. I know in many cases that will fail as a first experiment, right? So I think it's how do you experiment with the direct motives and decrease the indirect? And ironically, sometimes as I share about my son in basketball, I found with kids, even my son in academics, like they have to want it. Like, and I can nudge sometimes. I can, you know, my son has a bad grade. Like, I keep an eye on things. When he has a bad grade, I'll focus on, you know, okay, what are you doing about it? Like, are you asking for, you know, try to help him diagnose the root issue. Was it his, you know, was it a word? And I'll ask and I'll have him diagnose and self-reflect. And he's gotten to the point where then he would start, you know, answering, like, I would ask questions around, you know, like, did you work hard enough? Like, was it a work ethic issue? Or did you not ask for help? Right? Like, which of those is it? And then help him diagnose. And once he would start building the habits of diagnosing, then I've noticed in the past couple of years, his grades have relatively come up. So I think it's like when they have ownership, intervene in places. So like, let's say your son gets a bad grade, like almost then help him self-diagnose his roots to build up the ownership and his own awareness around it. But sometimes as parents, I've learned it, like, you know, having them, you know, slip and fall sometimes is really helpful to create, you know, maintain ownership, and then to help them through that and then build ownership where they end up then performing at a better level, whether it's sports or academics or hobbies.
Right. So thank you very much. This episode is probably one of the most influential and helpful for me personally.
Happy to hear that.
So then comes my signature question of the show. So what is your formula for creating value?
Yeah, my formula for creating value, you know, it's even think like I it really comes down to, you know, this is maybe a different flavor than you might be expecting, Meta, but like my my mission calling in life is to help people thrive at work and life. That is why I exist. And so, you know, with the research that we have at Vega Factor and the science that I've shared with you is to bring that to people. Like, and it's a great opportunity to partner with you on this and share it with the people of Turkey. So my formula is like, that is the problem, like help people thrive, help solve for the yuck in people's lives at, you know, predominantly at work, but also where applicable in life. And to bring that to people through different vehicles like this, or partnering with organizations, you know, around leadership work and team habits, or to help organizations truly transform so that people are thriving at work, feeling good, and not feeling all the yuck that gets in the way. Because fundamentally, like, you know, I think the more we can help people realize that these things all go hand in hand. Like, you improve motives of people, you're improving how they feel. Like, they sleep better, they enjoy what they're doing, they see the impact of it, they don't deal with the stress, anxiety, and yuck that exists at work in so many ways right now. That's a major impact when you can change someone's life around that. And by bringing our science to them and doing some other work to help people get there, that's really the secret sauce.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Rich, it was a great chat. And before we close, I would like to mention also, like, I would also include in the show notes the links to your website. You also have some self-tests, right, to measure their motivation and their teams?
Yes. And we're also shifting to kind of helping people get more into the habits on that meta. Kind of, you brought up the habits earlier, helping people being able to self-diagnose on those habits themselves and give, you know, people themselves tools directly on our website so that people can start fixing them on their own.
Wow, great. Awesome. So I'll include all of those, and probably they can reach you through LinkedIn, or do you have any other preference?
LinkedIn's great. LinkedIn's perfect.
Great. Well, Rich, thank you very much for all of these.
Thank you. It's a great privilege and opportunity to partner with you on this. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye.